Hello and welcome to the First Take Film Club podcast, where today we are tackling an early noughties classic, American Psycho. I'm your host, Liam Jones, and as ever, I am joined by my two exceptionally handsome colleagues, Luke Chanley and Connor Norcott. How are you, boys? Luke, how are you, my lovely, handsome friend? I feel like I've been kind to you boys today.
You are, and you are also handsome. Let's get that out of the way. That needs to be said first. Yeah, good. Thanks, mate. I'm a little bit tired, you know, like a little bit just jaded, really, this week. I haven't done a lot, really. Like, I've done bare minimum in terms of, like, work or, like, emails and stuff. So, but yeah, it's coming towards the weekend where you can feel not guilty about doing absolutely nothing. So I can't wait to get to there. But generally, I'm absolutely fine. Thanks, yeah.
Amazing. Connor, how about you, mate?
I have never felt so similar to Luke in my life, where I just feel guilty. It's my birthday on Sunday, and I feel like, because I know I'm not going to do anything over the weekends, I should have done work now, but it's Thursday. It's not going to be done. I have like two deadlines for next week, and a film festival that we're putting on comes on in about 10 days, and I've got some Q&As with directors who don't speak very good English, and it's going to be... Oh, I'm nervous. But apart from that, I'm doing all right. I had a really good bagel, drinking a cherry Coke, and you called me handsome. Everyone's been talking about how handsome we all are. Yeah. So I'm feeling good, man. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I have 12 days off work as of today. It is my birthday 3 days after you, Connor. We are very close in birth mm-hmm. and age. It's like we were just meant to be friends, I guess. So yeah, I've got 12 days off. I am relishing the opportunity to go into a beer garden as of Monday. I've booked a couple of places in next week to go and drink and to go and eat. The weather's not meant to be that nice though, so I guess I'll be in my raincoat and an umbrella because it's outside only. But I feel lucky to be able to go and bev anywhere nonetheless, because drinking at home is a little bit depressing. It's become depressing. At first it was a gimmick and now it's just sad. I can't wait for that. On that note, let's move on. So what we like to do is start with an opening question. And today I'd like to link it to our film American Psycho a little bit and ask you boys, what are some of your favorite films set in the 80s? Luke, I'll come to you first, mate.
Yeah, I've got two answers here. I'm worried that one of them might be the same as Connor's, but I'm going to say it. But I have got two of my, and actually, the second one isn't a film. It's like a episode of a TV show. But the first one is This Is England, because I think is that what you're going to say, Connor?
No, it wasn't, but that's what I should have said, to be honest.
Well, it's that. I think that's the only one that I can think of that wasn't from the 80s, so it's like that's nostalgic look. But like my actual like favorite, which is like probably it's like an hour episode, is San Junipero.
I knew you were gonna say that, bro.
So that's my favorite. Like if we're classing that as a film, which I'm gonna, because it's like episodic, isn't it, or whatever you call it. What do they call it?
Anthological. Whatever.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, it's one of them, isn't it? So I think it counts.
That episode of Black Mirror, I think that the 80s aspect of that film, there's not many TV shows or film that have depicted like the 80s scene as well as that episode. Like, there's a reason why it's Black Mirror's highest rated episode like ever, because it is just fantastic. So yeah, I knew you were going to say it, but I totally agree with you as well, to be honest. How about you, Connor?
Oh man, I've had to do a little bit of deep diving internet research for this because I can't even form my own opinions this week. I'm that lazy. But you know, I was so sure that Luke was going to say something like Ghostbusters, or which we kind of talked about. And you kind of
I was, to be honest.
Yeah, you blagged me off with that one, and I was going to go with the big niche pick of a foreign film, and I'm going to have to. And that film is Memories of Murder by Bong Joon-ho.
Oh, what a film!
Which I rewatched about two nights ago because I've been on this big watching a bunch of heavy, depressing movies. And there's something about that film that is so, first of all, I don't really know much about Korea in the 80s, but it seems like such a fucking fun place, and all the little restaurants and stuff seem like such nice little welcoming gaffes, even though all the murders are happening. And yeah, man, I think I'd like to go there. If I could go to any place in the 80s, let's make it South Korea.
Awesome. So for me, right, I think I'm going to have to give a bit of a weird answer. And it's only because I Googled some things and some things popped up and I was like, ah, yeah, that's an interesting answer. So I'm going to say Drive, which I know isn't set in the 80s, but it has such an 80s feel, right? Do you not think?
Yeah,
it has such an 80s feel. And like it's almost like a modernization of like the 80s aesthetic whereby I think, you know, not many films do that with like the neon and I don't know, just the feel of it. The cars even feel, you know, 80s-esque, and the costumes, although it is set in the present day, 2011, whenever it came out. So yeah, that's my little cheating answer. I think if I was to give a proper answer, God, I don't know. Maybe something like The Wolf of Wall Street, just because I think like you have like one side where you can depict like the 80s, like almost like subcultures of like the kind of music scene and whatever. But I think like the 80s kind of like Wall Street subculture where everyone's kind of dressed in the same suits, but it's all like everything just seems real kind of hectic and frantic. I like that is captured really well in Wolf of Wall Street. So yeah, I came up with this question and I really haven't given it a lot of thought, and I do regret that a little bit. But still, I mean, we've all given relatively good answers, right? I don't know if any of you guys have anything else to add to that. Very, very good, but also at the same time, kind of rubbish question.
I think Wolf of Wall Street's a really good shot because I think we'll touch on this a little bit with American Psycho. The kind of hedonism and excessivism of the 80s, especially in America, especially with Wall Street, is really fun to watch, even though the two films are quite different. Yeah. Like, and there's quite a lot of heavy, hard-hitting stuff in this. They are quite fun to watch. So I think Wolf of Wall Street is a good shot.
Yeah, for sure.
Just to clarify for me that actually I did say Ghostbusters first, and then I was worried that the question we were talking about earlier before the pod, I was worried that the question was like a bit different. So my answer would actually be Ghostbusters, but but if we're going there, looking retrospectively.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, if we were going for films that just came out in the 80s, that like it would be completely different, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure we'd go for, I don't know, something directed by Spielberg or, you know, something like Ghostbusters. Anyway, let's move on to the main event, which is American Psycho. So the film, if you're interested, had a budget of $7 million and grossed $34 million worldwide, which is fine. It's fine. I think it probably grew more of a cult following a few years after its release rather than when it first came out. It's directed by Mary Harron. It's developed from Bret Easton Ellis's novel, and it's written by Mary Harron again and Genevieve Turner. Isn't that exciting? Now, the cast is pretty great, right? You've got Christian Bale, Justin Theroux, Josh Lucas, Bill Sage, Chloe Sevigny, Reese Witherspoon, Jared Leto, and Willem Dafoe. The cast is stacked.
Mm-hmm.
I read before, which I didn't realize, that they were going to throw another 20 mil at this film just to get Leonardo DiCaprio to play Bateman, the main role. But Lionsgate, I think they decided at the end to just go with Christian Bale, which was a wise choice, in my opinion. I think he absolutely nails it. He is, to be honest. Well, in my opinion, I think he's great. I know people have their different opinions on Christian Bale, but I think he is a brilliant actor. Now, to sum up the film, little summary, it revolves around a wealthy New York investment banking investor called Patrick Bateman, who hides his alternate psychopathic ego from his co-workers and friends as he delves deeper into his violent, hedonistic ways. How spooky. Right, now, it's a first take for you, Connor, and for you, Luke, as well. So I'm going to throw it to, first of all, you, Luke, to give me your first takes and your first opinions of American Psycho.
Yeah, my first opinion is it was not what I thought it was going to be, and I can't quite put into words what I thought it was going to be. I think I kind of thought it was going to be less accessible and maybe like a little bit, I don't know, drier maybe, or maybe less like violent as well, maybe a bit more subtle. And it's like kind of a slasher-ish film, like not like full on like Scream slasher, but like it's, you know, it's quite brutal in some parts. But like having said that, I'm glad it turned out to be what it was as opposed to what I thought it might be, because I actually honestly think if I'd have knew what it was like, I would have watched it probably years ago, because I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really, really good. Not hard to get into, even though there was kind of like some, as we'll touch on later, so I won't go into too much, but like some like more ambiguous or slightly confusing elements. But like that didn't take away from anything. And actually, like I always thought it was the perfect amount of kind of like a bit of gore, some intrigue, a bit of thriller, and a bit of quite a lot of ambiguity if you look into it heavily enough. So like all of that just made up a really like solid, enjoyable package for me. So yeah, my first take on it in general is that it was just a really good film and not what I expected, but in a really positive way.
Connor?
Once again, not to sound too much like Luke's echo or shadow or his little parrot on his shoulder, I completely agree with all of that. And I felt so similar. And it's one of those films that I, unlike the last first take I had, which I can't remember what it was now, I didn't go in thinking I knew nothing about this. I thought I knew the whole thing. I thought I knew the film. Fucking hell, was I wrong? Like you said, Luke, it is really almost quite subversive, and it kind of doesn't play to the expectations that you think you have going into the film. And there's a weird kind of like chemistry to it when you watch the first 5 minutes of a film and you're completely engaged and hooked and just won over, and whatever comes next, you're there and you're strapped in and you're ready for it. When that happens in a film, you know it's kind of a special movie. And I had that within the first maybe 2 minutes. When he starts peeling off his little face mask, I was like, yeah, sign me up. I'm buying some of them. Let's go. I want to start doing 1,000 crunches. Let's fucking go. I loved it. It was sick.
Yeah, 1,000 crunches to the soundtrack of women screaming in the background. Isn't that absolutely fucking bizarre? Yeah,
love
that. So I watched this film for the first time probably 5 or 6 years ago. Hadn't watched it since I rewatched it last night. The first time I watched it, I remember liking it and enjoying it very much, being surprised by the ending. But the second time round, I didn't enjoy it as much, like at all. Wow. I don't know why. I do kind of know why. There are several things that didn't work for me. I think there are some bits that are almost too obvious. And then reading what the director and the writer have said afterwards, almost are contradicting themselves with what we actually see on screen. Basically, in terms of some of the kind of little bits in the middle of the film that are, in my mind, they were used to make us realize that something might not have been as it seemed. But then they were quoted as saying, I don't know, it might have been a few years after the film, but Arno Bateman is very much meant to be a serial killer. He has killed people. So in that sense, with that in mind, I don't know, is this something in my head that just properly threw me and maybe not enjoyed at all? Because I was like, well, why are you putting these little moments in to throw us and make us think, oh, maybe it's all in his head?
That's interesting.
If then afterwards you're going to say, oh, no, he very much is meant to be a serial killer. Or, oh, he's meant to be a serial killer, but he didn't actually kill Tom Allen, or Allen, his surname is Allen. Jared Leto's character. Yeah, there are many little things that kind of, for me, contradict themselves. And for me, piss me off a little bit. I just think when you're making a film, I think you have to stick with what you've made. Mm-hmm. And you can't like then say, oh no, this is something else when on the screen. I don't know. Maybe I'm not the one to say when the artist is the person that's made it, but I don't know. It just felt with keeping in mind what has been said by the director in the after the film. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It just kind of took me way out of what was happening.
I think there's something in that though, and it's really rare that one of us has this opinion where we just don't, it doesn't click with us. And I think that's that when the episodes are better, because we actually get to be like, well, what did you think about this? And did this do it? Did this kind of hit you the same way? And you're the only one here who's watched it more than once. So it'll be interesting to know if maybe for myself, Luke, if we ever revisit it, which I'm definitely going to because I loved it, if it kind of plays differently for me as well.
Well, I watched only 20 minutes of it just before the pod, so I watched a bit of it and then nipped for a shower. But I actually was reading, I've read a bit about, because the film is so ambiguous at some points, I was almost like, I find it difficult to form an opinion on the actual what's going on. So I just had a little look and I was reading about probably not dissimilar to what you read, Liam, about like what the director and the writers thought about the film. And from what I gathered from like various interviews, or maybe one, it was just one particular interview, that because the film has like a pretty vague ending, they were trying to replicate that. And they just, from what I gather, they just said they just got it completely wrong. Mm-hmm. And it was, because I read the same as you, Liam, where they said, yeah, this is, because obviously I was, a little bit later, but I was very much like, well, did he kill everyone? Did he kill some people? Did he kill no one? And it helped, reading a bit about it helps me figure out what I think happened, which again, we can kind of, I suppose, will be really fun for us all to touch on later. But I think from a second view or 20 minutes this morning, I'm quite excited to finish that off, because it gave me a few points to raise today about it, really.
Yeah, I think I know we would like to move on, but I think it is right though that the first thing that like intrigues us and gets us wanting to talk about this film is the ambiguity of it. Because I think if you're coming to listen to us talk about American Psycho, I think the first thing you want us to talk about really is, what do you think actually happened? There are moments in this film, we will get onto them, that are, in my opinion, like they're not ambiguous. They're very much heavy-handed in that, oh, this clearly isn't real, because it's so batshit over the top that it's clearly in his head. So I don't know. For me, I just think there are parts where maybe they're just over. They're made out to be maybe a little bit more interesting than they actually are on face value, which I will get onto a little bit later. There's a moment with an ATM and a cat that does kind of start a scene of a little bit a franticness where Bateman kind of loses his shit a bit. But yeah, the film does, it opens really with Christian Bale kind of with his internal monologue, as it were, which is pretty much taken, these moments of his monologuing, they're taken pretty much straight out of the book, word for word. And I think it's a clever way of doing it. I think when they've adapted it, I think it's important that they've taken that out, because ultimately, for me, including the internal monologue, it's the only way that we can like have a truthful look into Bateman's kind of psyche and his character and what he is actually feeling and thinking. I just want to know what you boys thought about these kind of internal monologues. It's very early on as well that we are introduced to his unhinged side, where he threatens to murder a lady working behind the bar. Mm-hmm. But obviously it's in his head, because he clearly didn't say it. Her reaction would suggest that he didn't say it. So what do we think about that?
When I was talking about that bit where when you're watching a film and like you're just like, okay, I'm in. It's really interesting as well that I think, first of all, that works completely. The inner monologue works, because how else are you meant to not sympathize, not empathize, but kind of understand the character, which is what you're always trying to decipher and do as you watch a film, especially a film that is a character study, basically. And what is really interesting to me is that it once again, it reminded me a bit of Wolf of Wall Street, where once you're not just talking about subject matter and, you know, yuppies and the fucking, you know, business or banking investors or stockbrokers or anyone who works on Wall Street. It's not just that, it's the fact that it's kind of centered around one guy, and also the crossover between, it was going to be, apparently you said, Leo, that was going to be Patrick Bateman, which just doesn't work, but it would have been an interesting film and we probably wouldn't have got Wall Street from it. Anyway, that's the bit when I was like, yep, sold, 100% sold. And it's all about Christian Bale's delivery and his kind of, his charisma and how he holds himself and the way Mary Hannon and her cinematographer kind of frame him, where he's either at the center of all the ongoings around him or he's completely alone, completely against, you know, monochromatic like black spaces as well. And he stands out, he instantly stands out, and you're instantly kind of not with him in terms of you agree with him, but you're instantly put into his frame of mind and you're instantly kind of given a sense that things might not be as sound as they seem to be.
Luke, what I want to throw to you is something that I thought was probably one of the best things about this film, and it's not anything to do with the kind of the sadistic, murderous side of Bateman. It's to do with the little subtle moments where he is around other people in a work environment, and you can see him slowly losing his shit. And one of the most, probably for me, one of the funniest things in this film is when they're comparing business cards. I just want to ask you, Luke, kind of, do you think, you know, yourself, did you find kind of this scene or any scene in the film kind of funny or comical or satirical in a way? And yeah, what did you make of kind of the kind of unhinged element of Bateman, but away from kind of the murderous side of him?
I did find it, yeah, I found the movie funny. It felt very early on like a satire, and which is quite helpful because I got that from, and I don't know how or why, but I got that from the inner monologue stuff being really meticulous. And I think from that, you know, his inner monologue makes him come across as meticulous and quite not formal, but everything's all in place, prim and proper. And then obviously his alter ego is, you know, he's stabbing people and he's being quite messy with it. And, you know, so it's very much alter ego. So that very much led me to believe that it was funny, a bit satirical. I did find it funny, but I also, it was very much dark humour, wasn't it? Like the humour was for us to find, not necessarily for them to do in a mm-hmm. weird way that kind of doesn't make sense but does. So it wasn't like overt comedy, but I definitely found it satirical and funny. But I'm trying to think now which bits. It's hard to pick out because it isn't an out and out comedy. Like, it's hard to go, oh, that particular thing was funny. Have you got one, Connor?
There is. We were talking about Liam, the business card scene. And first of all, that is just funny because it is everyone, you know, showing their business cards and they're all fucking more or less identical. And that's what's funny about it, is the kind of collective idealism versus the individual. And the whole film's kind of about all these little contrasts as well. But it's in the contrasts and it's in the juxtaposition where you get like all the humor from. And on top of that, I think, I don't know if Mary Hannon was involved in the screenplay as well as the directing the film, but there's so many little one-liners that shouldn't be, that aren't one-liners, but it's about Bale's delivery and how they kind of put off a scene or an interaction that are so funny to me. And there's a little moment in that scene where I can't remember the name of one of the, you know, incredibly similar looking business dudes that are in the room. Compliments one of the business cards, and Patrick Bateman just turns around and says, your compliment was valid enough. It's little lines like that that are so blunt and so, like, you just tears people down with them. I love it. So, and I think it's one of those things that's the bit for me that I want to go back on the second watch and kind of enjoy the comedy. And that's not something I tend to enjoy ever, really, yeah. Is comedy. So this worked for me.
I think they are quite playful as well with Bateman's relationships with his work colleagues, namely Paul Allen, who is Jared Leto's character, who Bateman clearly fucking despises because he has similar suits, similar glasses, similar hair, but he makes a point of saying, oh yeah, but my hair's better. Like, it is little like throwaway lines like that that are actually quite funny. Mm-hmm. And it just so happens that it is this guy that he so dearly hates that he ends up whacking with a massive axe. And I think, what do we think, like, makes the build-up of that, Connor?
For me, it's their relationship, and it's the complete, almost gut-wrenching envy, in my opinion anyway, that Bateman has for Paul Allen, because, first of all, maybe it is part of it is toned with hate, and because of the kind of person, they're all fucking deplorable people, and Paul Allen is kind of seen as the most successful, the most rich, his apartment's the nicest, his hair is beautiful, he wears all over people's glasses, or whatever the fuck it is. He's the kind of the champion for them or whatever. So Bateman, he always kind of seems like he's trying to climb up that social ladder, or kind of, I don't know what the term is, maybe, just kind of almost usurp him, essentially. So the only way Bateman will give in to this is by murdering him. And that kind of kickstarts the chain of events where things might not be real. And it's, once again, it comes back to the contradiction of appearance versus reality as well. And I find that really interesting. But the actual guts of the murder scene is hilarious now. Because I've seen it so many times in you know, on Instagram or on Twitter or in YouTube videos I can't even remember the name of the fucking band now or whatever. But
Huey Lewis in the News, is that?
Yes,
is that the
one? Yeah. And he starts talking about all their albums, and that kind of becomes a motif in itself, which I don't know how to unpack that on first watch. But that scene is fucking brilliant.
Something that is absolutely hilarious to me is that what actually cost them the most money is the rights to these songs, because you actually, here you have some of the biggest artists. You've got Whitney Houston, Genesis, Huey Lewis and the News, to name but a few. I can't think of the others, but I mean, those scenes where he's explaining kind of the artist or like a particular song, whilst in his head at the same time, you can tell that he's kind of psyching himself up to do a murder. Mm-hmm. Moving back on to kind of his killing of Jared Leto's character, did we suspect anything, Luke? Did you suspect anything was maybe not quite as it seemed, maybe not during the murder scene, but as he was dragging, you know, a body bag that was draping blood behind him? Did you think anything wasn't quite as it seemed?
Yeah, I think that's, unless I'm mistaken, which it could be, that's one of the first scenes where you are like, this is unusual. Like, it's just not lit. It's just not straightforward, is it? You know, he's fully in open air, dragging a body to the back of a car. And I can't remember if the blood being left behind as well. I think there might have been right in there.
In the hallway.
And so that's where you are like, this is just not quite usual. But I mean, I reckon there's probably other bits as well. Like, I mean, there's a bit where, you know, just before, just jump back slightly, where he's standing at the walkway, and he stands up next to a woman, and he just looks at her and says hello, and then it's not that unusual when you just say, oh yeah, I just said hello to a woman, but like the way it's done and the way it's put across, and then the way the woman reacts, and the way that actually nothing comes from that. So that's just a bit unsettling. So there is like little bits, but that's definitely the first bit where you're like, because the other bits are kind of like, yeah, we can get away with that. Maybe that's just weird, but that is very much like, I'm not sure what's going on here, really.
I think it's interesting that for me, one of the things that definitely did happen is something that we didn't see on camera, and it's when he gets the prostitute and I think one of his friends rounds, and yeah, like at first they have sex, and there is that bizarre scene where he's staring himself at the mirror and, you know, flexing his muscles.
Oh yeah, I hate
which
that.
Which is really weird. But then it kind of cuts away, and then the next thing, the two girls are walking out of the door with bruised faces, and you don't actually see that violence. And for me, that's actually like really important that they don't show it, because in a scene later on, he does murder another girl, and you do see that. So I don't think it's about you know, not wanting to depict violence against women, because that is there as well. So for me, I think probably the stuff we don't see is maybe more real than the stuff we do see. You know, he speaks at the end about he's killed maybe 20 to 40 people. Well, on screen, we only see him kill, you know, a handful of people. You know, I'm wondering maybe if the ones we don't see, you know, the actions we don't see, the violence we don't see is the violence that maybe is actually real. Mm-hmm. And the violence we do see isn't. That's a theory that I've literally just thought of right now. It's not, you know, it's just come to me right now. So I probably, you know, is wrong, but who knows? You know, that's why films like this are interesting. Luke, what do you want to say, mate?
Yeah, the thing with the and again, this is like, you know, a lot of these things as we talk about them and remember little bits that each other are saying, just kind of shooting into your head. But I think let's take a great leap forward to that bit where he says, "Oh, between 20 and 40 people he's murdered." He says it on the phone, but then I'll jump back again, but I think that number isn't right for a number of reasons, and we'll come to that later. I don't want to actually talk about that, but I just think if you take the two scenes where he's with the kind of his friend and the prostitute, and his friend and the prostitute again, one scene ends in them actually leaving the house or the flat, obviously with Bruce face and stuff, and obviously not great, but it all builds up, so it's like he's actually losing control. Mm. And then if he didn't want them to leave in the first scene, he wouldn't have let them, because in the second scene, when the prostitute tries to leave and runs away completely bollocko, he chases her, mm-hmm. and throws a chainsaw and good shot, like, so it goes straight through her. So like it's almost like it's ramping up, and he's going in from being like a sort of psychopath to like quite bad psychosis. And that's what I got from, like, because he's actually let them leave, hasn't he, at a point. So there must have been a ramping up between them leaving the house the first time and not leaving the second time, which is like probably about 45 minutes in.
The deaths become more far-fetched as well, don't they? Obviously, dropping a chainsaw from, I don't know, 10 stories up, and it, you know, just happened to land on the girl's head as she's trying to get away. And then obviously later on in the film, he just with one pistol manages to kill two policemen and blow up both their cars, you know. And he even like makes a point to like look at his gun, like, fuck, how did I just do that? You know, and that's maybe like where he's almost breaking character for a second. Like, what's going on here? There's something that is really interesting as well, moving away from the murders, is that there are many times in this film where people mistake him for someone else.
It's not just him, it's everyone.
Well, I was about to say that, yeah.
That's a big thing for me, and that's something I find this film really hard to give a first take on, because it's a film that I want to like tear apart and analyze and read about and, you know, break down scenes and stuff so you can understand it more. But I keep coming back to this thing of like the individual versus the collective, and obviously the film makes so many comments and deals with so many themes that aren't just one thing. It's not just a film about investment bankers or a slasher film about serial killers. It does everything, and I think it'd be really remiss to just box it, to label it as one. And that's why it's such a hard first take. I don't know if you found it the same, Luke.
Yeah, I did. And actually, like, a lot of, honestly, it's, you know, when you said you'd seen that, you didn't enjoy it the last time, Liam, was that only the second time you'd watched it, or was that?
No, just the second time, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So let's say, for example, I did only watch 20 minutes this morning, but I probably got more from that 20 minutes in terms of writing down notes than I did the first time, because obviously you're just kind of watching it and just, you know, you don't know it's going to develop into something which is going almost in like four different strands, which could be, you know, the timelines, could be anything, what's happening in the film. I'm going to continue watching it after this. I just took a lot, and the main thing that I actually took, so if we say, obviously there's multiple theories about what's going on here in this film, and you know, we probably will touch on it shortly. The thing that I got the most from watching this film again is that they all mistake, they mistake Paul Allen for not being Paul Allen. Mm-hmm. They mistake each other for being different people, and Paul Allen mistakes them for being someone else, because he does the monologue thing about the other guy with the same glasses and the same suit. So, and if we almost use that and then jump forward to, did he kill Paul Allen or didn't he kill Paul Allen? that makes it a lot more, a lot more vague for me, because because people are saying, oh, well, the only evidence we've got is actually we sat with him in London and had dinner with him. Well, you might not have, because you're all the same to each other. And it's really what you said about, and it just triggered me then when you said about, like, oh, they've all got each other mixed up. That's the biggest piece of evidence for me that, like, he might have actually done this murder.
The only thing that kind of, for me, disproves that theory is that his flat is empty, like, is empty at the end. Not only that, I'm sure the woman says he didn't even live there.
That when I was thinking before the podcast, I was thinking, oh God, well, that could mean that he has murdered him. And then I was thinking, but the flat, she literally says he's never lived. Like, that's the only way that's explainable for me, if you look at what's happened in the film, is that he goes to the completely wrong building at the end when he's gone mad, and he goes to go in, is it Parker and Parker, the company he works for, or P&P? He goes into a building next to it exactly the same. It's not the right building. So he shoots the guy behind the counter and shoots the guy, the bellboy, and then runs into another building, which is the right building. And I don't think that's a good enough theory, in terms of the only thing that stumps me is the flat thing. And I can't really explain it on, like, mm-hmm. 1.5 watches. But the only thing that I can say to that is either he just hasn't done it, or the psychosis has taken over, that he might even be in the wrong place or anything like that.
The thing for me is, in this film, and I don't want it to just be like a fucking InfoWars Alex Jones conspiracy podcast, but for me, first of all, I don't think he killed anyone. I don't think he has killed anyone at all. And I also don't think the film's about him killing anyone. Obviously, I said it earlier, I said it's remiss to say the film's about one thing. It's not. But the big overarching theme for me from the film is the kind of commentary on the excessive, you know, nature of the 80s, or the, you know, the kind of loose morals of these people that are being depicted in the film and stuff like this. So I think using the tropes and the genre conventions and the kind of narrative beats of films like slasher movies or horror movies or really over-the-top violent films kind of paints a picture of these people. And that's something that I'm like, oh, this film is really doing something, and I'm super here for this. And why? Obviously, everyone knows this film. Maybe that's why it's not talked about enough, because everyone knows it, apart from me and Luke, who now kind of know it. This film's fucking awesome. It really is really good. Anyways, we can move on.
Yeah, it was just what you were saying. So I, just to jump in dead quickly, I do think he killed people. Mm-hmm. And when I said before about the 20 and 40 number, I think he just doesn't know, because at this point, he's gone. At this point, he's imagining murder. So I don't think he'd kill Paul Allen, which is what I'll say as, like, a counterpoint to what I said. Mm-hmm. But I just think at this point, he doesn't know how many people he's killed, because some have been in his head and some have just been, like, you know, homeless people on the street or whatever. Yeah. But in terms of the commentary, just really quickly, it is about that. That came across quite obviously. But on the second little watch this morning, the thing I think got really interesting is that I actually think it's a commentary on just big corporate business in general, because when he's saying early in the film where they're around, I think he says it twice really, they're around the two sets of dinner tables, and at one point he's kind of saying, like, he's banging on about different causes, and what we actually need to do is we need to get behind this cause and do this, and he says we, and it's very much like, that's almost a commentary on, you know, for example, businesses getting on X, Y, and Z bandwagon. Mm-hmm. And he's saying
Sri Lanka, that was what he talks about, isn't it?
Yeah, he talks about Sri Lanka. And then there's also a bit in the beginning about anti-Semitism, but then there's all these different causes, and he goes on a bit of a monologue. And at the end, he says, oh, what we actually need to do is just to raise general social concern. And it's like, it's always, that's it in a nutshell. It's like,
sure, I've seen that Facebook advert. Yeah.
So I do think like it's a commentary on, like, you know, the murders that I think are real, but I just think in general, it's more about, like, the ruthlessness of corporate business. And it's almost like he is the business and the things he's going about doing and the attitudes he's taking, where, you know, because he very clearly says, we need to get behind these general causes, general social concern. But then in the scene next, he's saying to his assistant, I wear different clothes than that. You wear sexier clothes and wear high heels. I like high heels better.
You're so prettier just, than that, is what you
Yeah,
says,
you're prettier yeah. than that. And I definitely think it's like, this is what, in front of people, this is behind the scenes. But I do think he murdered people, yeah.
That's the mask. That's the peel in the face off. That's yeah, all of is, that. Yeah. That quote, "I simply am not there," is so good. And I've literally bought a hoodie with a little still from American Psycho on it. And it says, "I simply am not there." And it looks a lot cooler than I've just explained. But I'm telling you, it's going to be a banger. You'll see that one soon.
See, going back to a point I made earlier, right, and it's something that does still piss me off, and it is the fact that the director and the writer of the film have come out and said that he definitely is a serial killer, which then, I don't know, almost, for me, invalidates your opinion, Connor, and it was my opinion too, that he didn't kill anyone at all. So, I don't know, I think maybe it would have been better for them to not give their, make their opinions maybe heard in that sense. You know, if you're going to make a film ambiguous, leave it ambiguous. Don't give us a definitive answer, because I think by them saying that, it's either he's killed a bunch of people but he didn't actually kill Paul Allen, or it's he actually killed everyone, and Paul Allen, you know, the reason why, you know, because they confuse everyone for everyone because they're all, you know, vain, bone idle arseholes.
Love that. I love the use of bone idle. I've not heard that in so long. Quickly on that, that's a really interesting debate that could probably be a whole other podcast episode, is about the does it matter what the artist thinks when they make a film? Or is that the only way you can read it? Because at the end of the day, art is art, and ambiguity is kind of the what you see in a piece of art is kind of what it means to you anyway. And I completely understand that when a director says it's about this, I feel like, well, you're right. That does kind of invalidate my opinion, but that's why I really enjoy the David Lynch thing where he's like, someone asked him, I think it was maybe Charlie Rose asked him, like, oh, can you tell me a little bit about Mulholland Drive? And he's like, nah, I won't do it. And I like that.
I feel like if Mary Harron didn't get so, you know, she was noticeably quite annoyed with the way the film was perceived in the end. And if she wasn't so annoyed with how it was perceived and instead just gave her opinion on what she thought, then it might have been different, because at the end of the day, she is adapting from a book, so she can give her opinion. But for her to be so noticeably annoyed by how she feels that her vision wasn't portrayed correctly in the end, and that she, in her mind, you know, wanted Bateman to, you know, undeniably be a serial killer just with a few ambiguities, I think for me it takes away from, you know, ultimately what I think at face value it feels like, which is that, you know, anything could happen. You could take anything from this, you know, in terms of what he's done, or like what he stands for, and who is actually who at this point. You know, is he even Bateman? Who knows? You know,
that bit really confused me. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, can I just while I was on that quick point from the director, because yeah, well, it's only a second. I just wonder whether, in terms of what we say about how it's perceived, I don't think that's. I think that's just a problem on her, because she'd made the film, and what's actually happened is we've just took the perception from the movie, which is very, very ambiguous. And I almost see that as her just being like, she's basically like, you know, 95% of this film is absolutely amazing. Well, I think 100% of it is, but like in her eyes, and there's a bit that's been taken the wrong way, but then we're only taking that from actually literally what she's made. And it's made, some may call it confusing, other may call it open-ended. I don't really mind, I'm happy to call it open-ended, but I think that's more on her. And I'm just wondering whether, because she's got the source material, and I imagine that she'll know what's actually meant to happen with this character. So not what we're taking, and whether she's like, oh, well, no, he's a serial killer. And I just think it's her, maybe she's only got herself to blame in a way.
I think what is really interesting, I think you kind of mentioned it earlier, Liam, is that she's creating her own adaptation of source material. So in a way, she's looked at, read through the book American Psycho, went over the script and made a film about it. That is her interpretation of how things played out. I don't know the the book. I don't know the source material that well, but I imagine it's quite open-ended, as Luke said, and quite ambiguous, as Luke said. So I guess, really, we're kind of almost, we're not arguing semantics or anything, but really we're just kind of, we're kind of proving the point about what really good, great art is that it kind of does evoke conversations like this. And even though we're debating whether or not some guy dropped a chainsaw from 10 stories down and killed someone is a bit remiss, but whatever, man. That's the kind of the beauty of doing a podcast like this and talking about films and art, and I'm
yeah.
up for it.
So let's talk then, one of the final kind of big points I do want to talk about is this kind of, this final scene. Well, not the final scene, the kind of final action scene, which begins with... Bateman going to a cash machine and it, you know, appearing with the words, you know, feed me a cat or something like that, isn't it? And just so happens that in that moment, a cat is right next to him. And then a woman says, what the hell are you doing? Then he shoots her. And then a big kind of police chase kind of ensues. And then he kills two police coppers. He blows up two cars. He shoots a receptionist, a cleaner, and then he phones up his lawyer and he's like, look, I've killed all these people. And he kind of has this sudden like release, this breakdown kind of thing where like we actually, it's the first time we actually see any real emotion, any kind of human emotion from him, whereby he's like realized what he's perceived, you know, in his head, what he thinks he has actually done. But, you know, what I took from it is everything is over the top. So I think from, obviously we are seeing most of the film, I think probably 100% of the film is from his point of view, other than the fact that we do get a moment where Chloe Sevigny's character, she finds his notebook where it is just frantic lunatic, you know, scribblings in his book, where, you know, you can even argue that nothing in this film is real. And it's all just in his head, and he's, you know, been drawing all these things in his book, and what's actually in the book is what he's dreamt up of in his own mind. I think, to be honest, as well, like, what were your Connor? What's your opinion on, you know, the revelation of that kind of scrapbook of weird like drawings and stuff like that?
There's a really good moment from like a filmmaking perspective where you see that moment where she finds the journal or the diary or whatever. I think it's the diary because he always has it in front of him when people come in. And you see that on, it's also intercut with him breaking up with Evelyn, his girlfriend, played by Reese Witherspoon, or fiance, I think, whatever. And when you see the start of that scene, he's drawing the murder, the chainsaw kill on the table with a crayon, whatever. First of all, he only eats at really expensive restaurants. There's no way. Why? Where the fuck's the crayon coming from? Anyway, you see them kind of intercut, so you're not just seeing someone realize what's going on, but you're seeing him kind of almost fantasize about it and dream about it. And that in itself poses another question about, oh, well, is he just thinking about it? Or it's bad enough for someone to find that and find, you know, find the journal or whatever and see all the fucking horrible imaginations that are being, you know, scribbled down by him. It's even worse if they're, you know, reliving crimes that, or murders that he's committed. So I find that scene really interesting, but I didn't like the Chloe Sevigny's character a lot. I really didn't, and I don't really understand what her kind of purpose was in the film, except for the kind of scene where they go around and she kind of thinks that there might be something there, and he's got a nail gun to the back of her head. And there's little bits in this film that kind of didn't do it for me. And hopefully they'll probably get better over time or whatever. But I think on first watch, trying to decipher so much that's going on, that little bits just didn't stick. And I think the bit just before that revelation, like you're talking about, I think after that, either side of that revelation, there's a little bit of pace issues for me. And maybe I'm just being a bit too picky. I don't know.
Yeah, I think, Luke, what did you make of this whole, the kind of the big chase sequence, you know, starting with this ATM machine and kind of finishing with the phone call to his lawyer? Did you think it was all happening in real time? Do you think it was all maybe in his head, or?
I didn't. So I realized, well, I was obviously thinking about it after, and obviously the ATM is quite on the nose, quite obviously not happening, because that's just ATMs don't say feed me a straight cat. But like that, so that's quite clearly not happening. But then I do believe that whether the cat's there or not, I don't know. But I do believe that he then went on a killing spree after that. But I think it's almost intertwined with reality. Now, I think the point, in my opinion, the point that's supposed to be got across is actually reality and his psychosis are merging closer. So he's losing the plot basically more and more, because I think while the ATM thing doesn't happen and the murders do, the shootout, I think, may happen. But I don't think that, because he shoots. For one thing, I was thinking was he's got a lot of bullets in his gun for someone.
I thought the exact same thing.
So I don't think that some of it happened, and especially where he shoots the gun at barrels and then, or the car, and then it explodes. Because then he doesn't even look at it to be like, what the fuck? You know, he looks at the gun and then obviously runs off. So I kind of think there you're at a situation where reality is what one and another. And then the phone call to the lawyer. I thought that happened. Like, I thought the stuff that seemed quite straightforward did happen, in my opinion. But I like the fact that we don't know. Or I say we don't know. We clearly do. But I like the fact that we can discuss not knowing.
Yeah.
That's actually what makes the film for me, like, actually really, really exciting and quite good. You know, one of kind of like the top tier ones that we can talk about on the pod, because, like, you know, we've almost got like three, well, two and a half differing opinions here. So, but yeah, I think a lot of it happened, but some of it was supposed to show the lack of reality that's going on in his psychotic mind.
Yeah, I think finally the closing monologue. I think it is something that does almost bookend it, kind of in a kind of decent way, I guess. You know, it gives you some answers, I guess, in the sense that, you know, when he says there is an idea of a Patrick Bateman, and he talks of himself being like an abstraction, you know, illusory, and he kind of finishes his little monologue. The last thing he says is, "I am simply not there," you know, and that's it does add to the ambiguity, but it also can answer some things about the film, in the sense that, okay, he probably isn't all there in his head. You know, if he can't even grasp reality, he doesn't see himself as a fully formed human being, really. So if he doesn't see himself that way, then a film in which we are looking almost through his eyes, we can't really take at face value at all.
Yeah, I see that. And I also really love the end, where I think the final line and the final breakdown of the monologue is almost just a one shot of it, like a close up almost, that kind of constantly slowly pans in as the monologue's reeled off in voiceover. And I think the last line is something like, "There is no catharsis. This confession means nothing." I don't understand that. I don't understand what has happened, because it's a first take. Well, the whole "this confession means nothing" might allude a little bit to that point you were making, but go on ahead, Luke.
I think it's a good, like I said, I suppose earlier, it's a good film to like kind of discover things from as you go on and stuff. But I just think that whole thing is, because what happens when he sees his lawyer in the bar or in the breakfast bar or wherever he is, he says, I may be wrong, but I'm sure his lawyer kind of says, "Oh, that couldn't come from Bateman. That couldn't come from a Bateman," or something like that. Does he say that? And I kind of think, so what you've got there is you've got the beginning, this guy, Patrick Bateman, who's saying these things about, you know, social issues and appearing to care about social issues. And especially the line about, he says, "What do you want me to do?" And then Patrick Bateman says, "I'll just call it on the anti-Semitic lines." And then you fast forward to the end where he says, "Oh, Patrick Bateman couldn't do that, but he has done it." And he's actually forgot about all the bad things that he's admitted to. Mm-hmm. I think that's a corporate thing in itself, and where that, like, I'm finding it now, in my opinion, in politics, where you've kind of got a situation where actually if you just ride it out for 5 minutes, people will forget about it and it won't matter. As long as you say the right things as a business, you know, well, I don't know why, but Nestle comes into my head. Just ride it out, and as long as you're saying the right things later on or at some point, people will forgive or forget. or it doesn't even really matter that much.
That is very interesting. That's so a really, that's really kind of what I get from reading.
It. Yeah.
I think it's as well, you know, almost that closing monologue is kind of like the confirmation that he is like the American Psycho. You know what I mean? In the sense that, you know, by him saying he finds no catharsis in what he's done, you know, he gains no deeper knowledge about himself or no new understanding about anything, you know, despite everything he's done, you know, and he says this confession has meant nothing. Well, I think that in itself just proves that he is a psychopath.
Yeah, total apathy, isn't it? It's total lack of emotion. And
there is nothing there. I mean, all you have to do is watch some, I don't know, some serial killer doc to learn that most serial killers in the end, you know, are like that, you know, completely apathetic, don't really, they're cold. But then again, you know, if we want to link it back to kind of, you know, corporations and whatever, they are empty and cold and almost like lifeless and evil, you know, and it's almost a perfect setting for a man like this, right?
100%.
I don't know if you boys have anything to add to kind of the chat around this film. Connor, you look like
I do briefly, right?
Go on.
There's so many like, oh, they're in this. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
When I saw Willem Dafoe in the opening titles, I was like, wow, let's go. And then obviously I knew Reese Witherspoon was in it. And she's fucking sick in this film, man. She plays that kind of not perfect foil, but complete antithesis to someone that Bateman could wind up with, or you know, we now know that he's completely emotionless, but she's absolutely not that person. And their scenes together are hilarious, and the breakup scene especially is so funny to me. Is so funny. And yeah, man, I don't know. I just thought it would be nice to briefly touch on that. And even Willem Dafoe, who plays a detective in this. I'm here for that. Let's get a spin-off of Willem Dafoe as a detective. Maybe like in Inside Man when he plays a police chief for 5 minutes.
Yeah,
he's better than 5 minutes, man. Give him more than 5 minutes.
Right, okay. So just quickly, I know that we do need to wrap up, but in terms of something that is really, you know, confusing in terms of Willem Dafoe's inclusion, who is the detective, right? And he is investigating the disappearance of Paul Allen, who we later find out may or may not have been in London. Well, why is he investigating it if all he would have had to do is look at flight records? You know, it would have taken him 10 seconds. I don't know, man. There is a lot of things that, like, lean towards the fact that maybe he actually is dead. Why would there be a detective investigating this guy if all he had done is took a flight to London? I don't know. And I think the inclusion of a detective in this film is interesting. And the fact that he almost just kind of disappears, you know, halfway through the film, three quarters of the way through the film, without really mentioning, you know, he kind of like drops the case, isn't it? I think that's what happens, Luke.
I think the detective could be his conscience. And then as soon as the detective backs out, when he loses grasp on reality, I don't know if that's a thing, it just pops into my head, but it's got to be something because it's so fleeting while still being actually quite, if it's, you know, if this is, let's say, your bog standard kind of slasher film, then a detective being in it is quite an important part of the movie because someone's being killed. But if he disappears at a point, because he obviously thinks, doesn't he? He thinks he's being, caught out, I suppose. And I'm just wondering whether there's something there around the idea that actually when he disappears, that's when grasp on reality kind of does detach a little bit more.
Well, the detective is the one who says that Bateman was there. Bateman has an alibi, and it's the detective that tells him that. And he's like, oh, yeah. So maybe you're right, man. I don't know. I feel like I'm back in my first year of film studies discussing American Beauty or something like this. This is good, man. This is well better than planning a film festival. I'm well over this.
Right. Are we all American Psycho'd out, right?
I want to say one thing: the score and the music's boss. That's I just think we just need to always just say that and then say we're running out of time, but that needs to be said.
I did forget to say that. Yeah, the score in particular, I think, really does add to kind of the feel, the vibes, as it were, of the film.
The strings, the big sharp violins, strings, beauty.
Very, very, very well done. Popcorns, boys. I'm going to give mine first. A lowly 62 popcorns from me. Sorry, but it's 3 stars, I guess. I enjoyed it enough, right? It's above 60s. Surely that has to be a recommendation, I guess. Luke, what about you?
I think 81. I think, because 81, which probably has quite a decent scope to go into the later 80s, just in terms of just like intrigue and excitement and thinking about the movie and not knowing what's going on. Mm. But yeah, 81 for now.
I think I'd give it a 75 popcorns. Awesome. Really good first take. Really enjoyed it. Love chatting about it. Some issues with it a little bit, but I think I'm also just not smart enough to work it all out on the first take. So we'll see. And we'll probably get back tomorrow when I watch
it. By the looks of it, the director isn't smart enough to figure out what she made either. So do you know what I mean? On that note, before I get cancelled, let's go on to talk about next week's film, which is Max Barbecue's Palm Springs, starring Andy Samberg and Christine Milotti. This is going to be exciting, right? I've heard a lot of great things.
I'm really excited for this one, actually. Like, it's one where I did it this week. I watched the film quite a few days earlier, and I think for all of us that's quite rare, isn't it? Because we are usually quite busy, and then we're like, oh yeah, the night before job. That's one I think I might just watch tomorrow and then try and watch it again if it's good. So I am excited to see this.
It comes out on Prime tomorrow, doesn't it?
Tomorrow, yeah.
Yeah, I know nothing about this. And I also know I know that it's been talked about quite a lot and everyone raves about it. And also that, when was the last time we did a comedy film on the podcast? Wild.
Well, it's Monty Python, probably.
It's a Groundhog Day-esque rom-com, isn't it?
Yeah, news to me, that, mate. That's news.
So the premise is they are stuck in a time loop at a wedding, and they fall in love, I guess, throughout the film. But I mean, it can't be that simple, right? Because the ratings are very good. You know, I've heard nothing but good things about this film.
Yeah, me too.
Super looking forward to it. We haven't done a brand new film in a while, right? Since maybe Mank a few months ago.
So
very much excited to do Palm Springs next week. So you lovely listeners at home, if you could please follow us on Twitter and Instagram at First Take Pod, and just give us a nice rating and share the pod with your friends and family. That would be much appreciated. Because, you know, we do try and give you good content every now and then. So on that note, until next time, it's goodbye from me and it's goodbye from the boys.